housework, if you could just make a note of these dates. This whole week is set aside for committee meetings. There are no plenaries. We are scheduled to have the public protector on Thursday, the 8th. Mr. Romano informs me now that the public protector herself won't be able to be here. And so my question to him was then, who will be here? And he said, the deputy public protector. And I said to him, well, that would be improper. The rule that you don't determine your own salary and benefits apply. So she cannot come here and discuss with the committee what her salary and benefits should be. So how that's going to pan out, we'll have to see over the next couple of days. I don't even think she should even be present. So there's a possibility that they may send the CEO, but I do recall in a previous meeting either one of them saying that they would prefer that the staff don't know what the discussions around the Deputy Public Protector's salary and benefits are. So it's really, I'm just informing you so that you're aware, okay? Mr. Jeffrey, and then?
No, Chair, I mean, I don't think we any request. Is there a request we have a closed meeting?
No, there isn't, but...
So then the staff could learn if they pay the money.
Well, that's another matter. You know, unless you are saying we should have a closed meeting.
No, I'm not saying that.
But they said they didn't want the staff present.
Yeah. But look, Chair, there's enough material. I mean, I think there's enough material to discuss. Yeah.
Debbie Schaefer.
Chair, I mean, this is going to be publicized anyway, but sure. So I really don't think it makes any difference.
All right, but you do agree with me that it wouldn't be proper for the deputy to be here, yes?
If we don't do it, I mean, the one aspect, I don't know if Mr. Bassett knows about this, but I understand the code of good administrative conduct, which is being withdrawn, that the minister was going to informally table a copy. Maybe they could give us that briefing if we don't proceed with the public protector. But I think we've got enough, even if there's nobody.
Yes.
We've got documentation.
Yes.
We've got a lot of things I think to discuss.
Sure. No, I'm not saying there's no meeting. That don't misunderstand me. We'll find a reason for a meeting. We've got enough work on our hands. The other thing is with regard to the Deputy Public Protector, Mr. Romano has taken the initiative of just checking with people like the Treasury and the Ministry, and they're not aware of all this. So perhaps in our consideration of this meeting, of this matter, we need to also touch base with someone from Treasury, if only to give us some kind of guide, and similarly with the Ministry. That's that. The 17th is our meeting with the Magistrates Commission, starting at 10 o'clock in Pretoria. Some members will leave on the 16th and sleep over. And then it is intended that the 22nd and 23rd will be our visit to Bloemfontein for oversight purposes. And I spoke to Mr. Frolic during the lunch break, and he doesn't have a problem with it. The next thing is, you may deem to be rather good news. He's asked me to submit the application for our visit to the United States. He doesn't think there'll be a problem because the motivation sounds good. I will, however, attach my letter of motivation to the application form that Mr. Romano will submit. Well, I pretend I didn't hear that. Okay.
Chair, before we start, but on the bill.
Right.
Can I just take going back one step?
This sort of rethinking of the earlier discussion. I am worried about what seems to be the arbitrariness of and the rationality of a 15 times increase in the fines. And, you know, that the introduced bill was 200,000 per annum. It's gone up to 3 million, 15 times. Now it's a question of why 15, why not 10, why not 20? What's the rationality? So I'd really want to suggest that more work is done in terms of looking at this issue in comparative examples. That was number one. Number two then was on this last section that we've done of factors to be considered in sentencing. One of the issues that NPA seem to be concerned about is the involvement of organized crime in trafficking. And that seems to be linked to the reason why they want to have the huge sentences if there's organized crime involved. But it's not a factor listed under 14. And should it not be listed as a factor to be considered?
That organized crime be involved in the sentencing?
Whether there was any involvement, it would be obviously the accused, but whether the accused was part of an organized crime syndicate involved in trafficking. But some way of saying that if you, it's not accused anymore, the convict or whatever, person who's been found guilty, was involved, was part of an organized crime syndicate. Where? H. Oh, whether the offence formed part of organised crime. Okay, no, it says there. Sorry. Okay, I will take that back. But I think the main. Can I keep the thing of
motivation for a huge increase?
The huge increase in looking at comparative aspects, because it just is. I'm worried about the rationality aspect. It's purely with the monetary sentence, not the custodial sentence.
Mr. Chair, I unfortunately was not that present at the first presentation, but I can recall that I prepared reference to various acts pointing out the different, monetary and fines. I don't know whether that was submitted to the committee.
Okay. Presentation. I've got a feeling it was, Mr. Chair, wasn't it? No. Use that as basis for our comparison that Mr. Jeffries asking for.
All right. So back to the bill.
I'm just going to ask Ms. Stone to refer to something. There's a footnote that we didn't deal with, if I can take you back just quickly.
If I can take you back to clause 8, conduct facilitating trafficking in persons, that will be on page 24. Actually, the relevant subclause there is subclause 2 on page 25 with regard to the duties placed on an internet service provider which must take reasonable steps to prevent the use of its service and that must report the internet address to the South African police and so on. You will note there is a footnote 106 which deals with section 24C of the Films and Publications Act and which provides that any person who provides child-oriented services including chat rooms or mobile cellular phones or the internet must monitor such services and take such reasonable steps necessary to ensure that those services are not used in the commission of offences against children. Section 24C came into operation in March 2010. We had further discussions with an official of the Films and Publications Board regarding the effective monitoring of the service as required by Section 24C. We were advised that it is difficult to monitor the services directly because of issues such as personal privacy and communication, and that more focus is placed on awareness raising. Also, in terms of Section 24C, service providers must put mechanisms in place to enable the reporting of suspicious behavior and provide children and their parents with tools which can be used to filter or block access to those services. The Internet Service Providers Association of South Africa also has a code of conduct in which specific provision is made for the protection of minors. The Firms and Publication Board have further advised us that internet service providers generally comply with the contents of that code of conduct. And the committee's views as to whether the provisions of Clause 8 should be amended in accordance with Section 24C of the Firms and Publications Act, and whether we should get the inputs of the Service Providers Association. Please.
Mr. Jeffrey.
I'm not sure if this... I would have thought it sufficient. I mean, the Internet Service Provider 2A must take all reasonable steps to prevent the use of its service for hosting. Is that not sufficient, particularly when it's a section that's new and how it's going to work is a bit unclear?
The concern, as I can recall, was raised in I think it's the public hearings, and they from there we did a bit of research, and this was just sort of a response to that.
But surely all reasonable steps would include making use of existing legislation. So it's already in the law, 24C. And it's I don't think we need to repeat it.
Or make a cross-reference.
Well, it already applies.
Okay.
That's the thing. So they're bound by 24C, which is that they must monitor the services and take reasonable steps to ensure that they're not used for the commission of offences against children.
It's not imposing any obligation on them to monitor people's private conversations or communications at all. It's just saying that they've got to take reasonable steps to make sure that trafficking information is not displayed on their websites. I mean, it's not monitoring anything other than to make sure that it's not contravening the law. And why only children? I mean, if it's trafficking sites, it can also affect women. So I don't think we should be restricting that. You know, it's only if they see something, or as I say, there is already a code of conduct, that would be one of the reasonable steps that they take. And if they didn't become aware of something that is promoting trafficking on their site, then I don't think that it's a problem to say that they should take steps to make sure that it doesn't continue to be broadcast.
I think, isn't it, as Mr. Jeffrey says, it's fine.
They are bound by it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
So then we come to the next chapter, which is dealing with the identification and protection of victims of trafficking. Chapter 3, we start on the bottom of page 33 and go immediately over to page 34, clause 15. And my colleagues are going to assist me in this portion of the bill.
Starting with clause 15, subsection 1, 2, and 3 have been in the previous version of the document that we had, so we haven't made any additional changes to that. Coming to subclause 4, the only amendment that we've made there in the second line of subsection 4 was the reference, you will see we've deleted 7 or 8, and we've now included specific reference to subsection 1, section clause 81B or 2B or 92. Just going back to subclause 3, B, you will see that we've also included all other disciplinary action, and this was based on the request by the committee that we need to include it there. Going back to subclause 4, paragraph A, B, and C have been in the previous document that we had. The changes that we've made here is in subclause 6. You will remember that a committee suggested previously that we need to build in a mechanism in terms of which one would be able to find that a child is a child victim of trafficking. How it currently works is that a child will be referred either to a designated child protection organization or the Provincial Department of Social Development, which must then conduct an investigation into the matter. What they will then do will be to compile a report on whether the child is a child in need of care and protection, and the child will then be referred to the Children's Court, and the Children's Court can then at the end of the day make a finding that the child is in need of care and protection. But at no stage does anyone make a finding that a child is a child victim of trafficking. So based on that, we've included subclause 6, which reads now, the Provincial Department of Social Development must in its investigation refer to in section 110.5 of the Children's Act without delay in the prescribed manner assess whether the child concerned is a victim of trafficking. We have discussed this with the Department of Social Development and they do support this provision. What you will also see is that in subclause 6, we only refer to the Provincial Department of Social Development that must assess whether the child is a victim of trafficking, and we did not include the designated child protection organization because of the fact that with regard to adults, the committee felt quite strong that it must be the department that do the assessment as to whether an adult is a victim of trafficking. That's why with regard to the assessment of children, we've only included the Provincial Department of Social Development and not a designated child protection organization. But in our discussion with the Department of Social Development, they actually feel that one should also allow the designated child protection organization to assist whether or not the child is a victim of trafficking, because they feel that the situation of children is a little bit different than when you come to the assessment of adult victims of trafficking.
Mr. Jeffrey?
I don't understand that last bit. I mean, at this stage it is the provincial department must assess. There's no reference to an accredited organization.
We're dealing here with adults. When it comes to children,
I'm talking about children, I'm talking about 6.
Yep.
Six will be
related
to children. When it comes to adults, it will be talking about.
When it comes to adults, you will then talk about an accredited organization. What I've just mentioned was that with here in subclause 6, we only make reference to the Provincial Department of Social Development, and we have not included a designated child protection organization because of the concern that we had with regard to adults.
Yes, and we don't want it for adults either.
Yes, and we haven't included it for adults.
So what are you talking about? I thought you were saying now that Social Development felt that accredited organizations should be involved in the assessment of children.
No, that is not what I said. With regard to children, relating to subclause 6 here, what I'm saying is that we should also then refer to a designated child protection organization or the Provincial Department of Social Development, meaning that it will either be the Provincial Department doing the assessment or the designated child protection organization only when it comes to children.
I'm not following, Jay. We want it the Provincial Department to do the assessment, full stop. No one else. Where is this thing? I'm not understanding the Steenman in terms of saying, are they wanting a designated organization to also be involved?
If I could come in here, I think Social Development has indicated that they want a designated children's organization to do it as well, and the department feels perhaps it isn't advisable to do it, and that's why we haven't included what Social Development has requested us to do, because I think in terms of Section 110(5) of the Children's Act, those investigations are done either by, and Stephen must help me here, are done either by...
I think the reason why the department felt it with regard to subclause 6, we should also refer to a designated child protection organization, because if you look at the Children's Act, the investigation will be done by either a designated child protection organization or the provincial department of social development.
Chair, just to get clarity, the way it's worded at the moment in this new 6, that is the provincial department doing it, and that's the way we want it. Okay, and incidentally, Chair, I did discuss it informally with the Minister of Social Development, who was very happy with that. So I'm not sure how wide they've discussed it in the department.
There's someone wanting to speak back there. From Social Development?
Yes, thanks, Chair. I think we have noted the requirement from the committee that it should strictly be a social development matter. We were just noting the concern that if you are referring to Section 110 in the text of this bill, for example, you are now saying provincial department of social development must in its investigation refer to in Section 110(5) of the Children's Act. Now when you read that clause, in that clause, there is mention of designated, child protection organization. So it was a question of, perhaps bringing it here and to get this the clarity on which version finally should actually go. We don't have a challenge really much, with if we were to remove it. It would have been good considering that there could be challenges elsewhere relating to your capacity sometimes, but I mean, if you cross-reference this way, it might perhaps be difficult to get the correct meaning of section of the clause.
Debbie Schaefer.
So, Chair, then should we not take that reference out to Section 110 of the Children's Act? Do we have to have that in there? And how will that impact on the rest of the bill? Because I can see what he's saying. I mean, if Section 110 refers to the designated, then it's going to be a confusion.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Why can't it be the Provincial Department of Social Development must, without delay, in the prescribed manner, assess whether the child concerned is a victim of trafficking? Okay.
Okay. Does the in the prescribed manner not bring in the designated? No. Okay. All right.
We haven't made any additional changes to subclause 7.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, just to interrupt. I just want to go back to 3B. I mean, I'm not aware of civil action being disciplinary, so I don't know why we're saying other disciplinary action. I think we should take out other and just say disciplinary.
Okay.
Going to clause 16.
Okay, sorry, can I interrupt? I just want to alert. We've got to come back, because subclause 7 deals with the person who fails to comply is guilty of an offence.
Yes.
Although that doesn't say it here, the corresponding provision in clause 16, which Louise is going to deal with now, and the committee asked us to just keep in mind that the corresponding provision in clause 16 also criminalises the failure by a policeman or woman to take action. So we still need to address that, but I think we can deal with that when we get to clause 16, end of clause 16.
Just ask, why is this provision here when the other ones are all together?
Yeah, the penalty, this is just criminalizing it, but the penalty for non-compliance is dealt with elsewhere.
Okay.
Sorry, Mr. Swan.
Police officials would not be charged, so we would have need to make it applicable under the circumstances.
I think my recollection last time was that the committee would like to think about it again, but I think the committee was veering towards not criminalising the police officials.
Yeah, I thought we took a decision, but I'm not standing.
Yeah, on the state liability.
This is the way we record it, and as I say, I might be wrong because I put this in. Portfolio Committee on 17, that's on footnote 200, on 17 August, indicated that it still wanted to reconsider subjecting a police official to criminal sanctions, especially with reference to the protection of the harassment bill, and it would like to have a look at some similar legislative provisions. That's where I have it.
The issue was, I mean, we dealt with the criminalization of police for not acting in the protection of harassment bill, and we decided then not to do it, so it doesn't then seem consistent to penalize them elsewhere.
It seems that's our position, Mr. Bassett.
Then clause 15.7 is fine as it stands, and then we'll have to adapt clause 16, 15.
Going to clause 16, page 36. Subclause 1. In subclause 1 provided for under option 1 is the same as what we had in the previous document. What's new here is option 2, going over to page 27. In terms of subsection 1A, everyone has an obligation to report. 1B provides that despite paragraph A, a person who is bound by a law or policy or code of conduct which prohibits him or her from disclosing any personal information must first request the written consent of the victim. And this is basically in line with what the Portfolio Committee suggested the last time, that we have to obtain the written consent of the victim before reporting that he or she is a victim of trafficking.
Yeah, I asked if there can be some comparative studies on those, that to two issues. That was one of them, and the other one was on the issue of compelling professionals to disclose.
We did, and perhaps we should have circulated the document. Maybe Ms. Stone can help us. She did some.
While Engela is looking for the document, perhaps I can just raise one of the concerns by the Department of Social Development. They feel that it will be problematic for social workers to have or to obtain written consent of a victim, because social workers also have to do field work and they will not always have the prescribed form with them. So the suggestion from the Department of Social Development is that one should only refer to consent and not written consent. What you will also see in paragraph C, we have provided for certain exclusions where written consent will not be required. That will be in a case where there's an immediate threat to the safety of the person, where consent is being withheld due to fear of reprisals, where the person is mentally disabled, or where the person is in an altered state of consciousness, etc. Yeah, Engel, I got a document.
I found a few acts South African, in terms of South African legislation, which places duties on professional people to report for it. Let me just see. The Collective Investment Schemes Control Act of 2002 places a duty on an auditor to report irregularities. The Drugs and Drug Trafficking Act 92 puts an obligation to report certain information to the police. In terms of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act of 2004, there is a duty on any person who holds a position of authority to report corrupt transactions. Once again, the Auditing Profession Act of 2005 has a similar duty. The Children's Act provides in section 110 that any correctional official, dentist, homeopath, immigration official, labor inspector, legal practitioner, medical practitioner, midwife, minister of religion, nurse, occupational therapist, physiotherapist, psychologist, religious leader, social service professional, social worker, speech therapist, the teacher, traditional health practitioner, the traditional leader or member of staff or volunteer worker, must report a child which has been abused in a manner causing physical injury or was sexually abused. Section 141 of the Children's Act also provides that the social worker or social service professional who becomes aware of certain contraventions in terms of child labour must report that to the Department of Labour. And then of course section 288 of the Children's Act, which deals with the instances of a child victim of trafficking, also provides that an immigration official, police official, social worker, social service professional, medical practitioner or nurse must refer that child to a designated social worker for investigation. I've also included some acts where there's mandatory reporting by the public. For instance, the Inquest Act. Any person who has reason to believe that any other person has died and that the death was due to other than natural causes must report that to a police officer. The Firms and Publications Act provides that any person having knowledge of the commission of any offence regarding the pornography or sexual exploitation of children must report that to the police. The Firearms Control Act has similar provision that any person who is aware of the existence of a firearm or ammunition that's not in the lawful possession of a person must report that. The Older Persons Act.
You're in a lucky day,
yeah. And then of course the Criminal Law Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act places an obligation in terms of Section 54. It states that a person who has knowledge that a sexual offence has been committed against a child must report such knowledge immediately to a police official, and there's a similar duty with regard to a sexual offence that has been committed against a person who is mentally disabled.
Sorry, can I just have a clarify on that last one? Can you just repeat that one, please? The Criminal Law Sexual Offences?
It's Section 54 of the Criminal Law Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act.
Impose an obligation despite whether the person consents or not, adult or child.
It's a person who has knowledge that a sexual offence has been committed against a child must report such knowledge immediately to a police official.
These provisions, do any of them require the consent of, let's leave out children because they can't really consent. Are there any provisions requiring consent? Then it seems to me that it's option one, obligation to report. Charity, is consent required in any of these other laws, particularly relating to adults? So the Sexual Offences Act. So let's leave out children, but Sexual Offences Act in knowledge of commission of a crime, is consent required for adults?
Mr. G, first one is against a child, and then the second one is a person who has knowledge against an offence that has been committed against a person who is mentally disabled must report that. So. No,
that's also a person who can't consent.
Can't consent, yeah.
Is there a duty to report? Let's forget about the auditors and things like that, because they have to report what they see. In any of these other matters, is there an obligation on a person to report an offence of this kind of nature?
The act that I've referred to, I couldn't find any provision of consent.
No. The Drugs Act and the Criminal Law Sexual Offences, the Section 54, does that relate to adults and children? No.
And people who are...
Maybe just okay. So there's not anything that imposes an obligation to report adults who are able to make their own decisions. We also with an international comparisons, if that was possible, as well as on the issue of consent, particularly in relation to trafficking victims.
I've got a few countries that the legislation there. For example, Zambia, in Section 25 of the Anti-Human Trafficking Act, provide that an immigration officer, labour inspector, social worker, medical practitioner or nurse must report a victim of trafficking to the police. In Ghana, Section 6 of the Human Trafficking Act provides that a person with information about trafficking shall inform the police or may inform the Commission of Human Rights and Administrative Justice or the Department of Social Welfare or a reputable civil society. With regard to reporting requirements in Australia, there's quite a lot of information I don't know whether it wouldn't be better if I can provide the committee with the document. Yeah, I can maybe just mention of one or two of the states. In New South Wales, the person who is mandated to notify is the person who in the course of his or her professional work or other paid employment delivers health care, welfare, education, children services, residential services, or law enforcement to children.
Yeah, just to make things go a bit faster, we're not interested in children. Okay.
Yes,
because obviously the requirement is that must be reported. Okay, so don't give us, it's wasting our time a bit to give us international comparisons or other comparisons of children or mentally disabled people who cannot give consent. What we've got to look at is for adults, is there going to be a duty to report, and is consent needed? And I think the issue would be generally that there isn't there doesn't seem to be much of a duty to report for adults, because probably the assumption would be, well, they can report themselves. But in the case of a traffic victim, they're not in such a position to be able to report. So hence, that's why this duty is being looked at. And it then becomes a factor of, does the need, as in the introduced bill, does the need to be the consent of the victim, or should the person just have an obligation to do it?
So, Chair, my particular concern is that we don't want to take away adult consent, but if they aren't in a position to give it, obviously we don't want to prevent people from you know, being able to report. But that's why I specifically wanted to see trafficking-related legislation in any other country if they have already got it, because you know, we don't want to take away people's rights unless there's a very good justification for doing that, and this may well be one of those cases. But I mean, we need to find that balance between, you know, not taking away their right to consent, but at the same time, if they aren't able to, we don't want to stop them from being protected.
Thanks, Chair. I'm just thinking back to when we certified this piece of legislation. I did do some research, but I can't remember exactly who it was, but my research at the time, I remember when other countries, when they had legislation, when it came to adult victims of trafficking, they say the police, they use the word may instead of must, so we didn't compel them, but it gave them the option to report. So when it came to adult victims of trafficking, they use may and not must, whereas in this one we got must, that's why we require the written consent. But even it never had written consent, but they use the word may, not must. Just to mention, when we did our comparative research, with regard to adults, I didn't come across any country where written consent is required in the legislation. The reason why we've included written consent in this bill was based on the public submissions that we've received, that one should not just place an obligation to report a crime being committed against an adult, because an adult has a choice as to whether or not to report a crime, and that's why we've built in the whole issue of written consent. But comparatively, it's not required when it comes to adult victims of trafficking.
The issue is not so much the consent, it's the question of, is there a duty to report? That's the issue. Is there a duty to report if you suspect somebody is a victim of trafficking?
An obligation.
Okay. What we've heard from the state law advisors is that the other countries don't provide a duty, an obligation. It's an option. It would seem that an option is a bit meaningless, because of course you can report anything. So I'm not sure what the point of that would be. And that then seems to be why this whole issue of, okay, have a duty, but have a requirement of consent. Have an obligation to report, but have it an obligation to the requirement that you get consent. So that's the stage we're in, and we need then to be given detail of research on our own law for relevant cases. So tax stuff and things that you pick up in audits is not relevant. Issues relating to children is not relevant in this case. It would be things like sexual offences where a medical practitioner believes that a person has been sexually abused, an adult. Do they have a duty to report? And we've then got to weigh up, do we then want to put an obligation to report? Do we want to go for the second option, which is that you've got to get consent? It doesn't have to be written consent, but you've got to get consent. But you then have a duty and obligation to report if the person, you think the person is being threatened, is withholding their consent because they fear reprisals, is mentally disabled or in an altered state.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see something in writing comparative, as you say, specifically on points regarding trafficking in our country and other countries who have trafficking legislation. But, I mean, at the moment, I must say I'm inclined to prefer option two, because I think that it does impose the obligation, but it does give those outs for the generally applicable conditions of trafficking victims, from what I understand, and that is, you know, after the state, you know, dragged off and dragged or threatened or whatever. And I think that provides that option. So I prefer that one at this point. But I would like to see a document, please, regarding comparative studies. Regarding consent, I mean, you know, is there a duty, and then we don't have to worry about consent for adults, as well as duties imposed on practitioners, like medical practitioners, who have ethical obligations not to.
That's a concern.
The Chair, I think that's a good idea. We need to get that. The option two, though, is very complex, because you've got despite a subject to B and C and with the exclusion of two. So so you've got to read each. But I think it captures a lot. It might well be the preferred option, so let's look at what we've got. I just wanted, the one case you referred to, the African case, was it Zambia or Ghana? Did you say Zambia? And in that case, is the consent required? What was it, Zambia? I think there was a duty to disclose without consent being required at all.
I've got in Zambia Section 25 of the Anti-Human Trafficking Act, and in Ghana Section 6. In terms of the Zambian Act, an immigration officer, labour inspector, social worker, medical practitioner or nurse must report a victim of trafficking. I'll just have to go and specifically look for the whether the consent is necessary. As well as the Ghana Act, that is a general obligation, provides that a person with information about trafficking. Says shall inform.
Mr. Chair, from a practical perspective, I think making consent a requirement.
Before you go on, can you identify yourself?
Colonel Enos, South African Police, DPCI.
Okay.
Making consent a requirement can become problematic in the field. I've done at least the last 50 cases of human trafficking in the Western Cape. I've spoken to the victims there, and not in one of those cases would it have been possible to get consent from that victim. So I don't think it's practical to look at the requirement of consent.
That's, option two covers those issues in any case. I mean, option two says you don't need consent if they are drugged or unable to or threatened or whatever, so that would cover that.
Christine?
My question is one of clarity. If you talk about mental disability, are you covering mental illness? Because you could have someone who's psychotic or, but is maybe not mentally disabled.
Yeah,
think it would. We'd have to. I think we'd have to sharpen up on that.
I want to say one more thing. I mean, just on the issue of may, of the provision where they may report, I mean, I think that it would cover the situation, giving people the option in situations like what we were considering, like medical practitioners and so on. You know, it's not saying anyone can report anyway. They may well feel that they're obliged not to report by the ethical code, but if the Act says that they may report, then, you know, then that covers them from that point of view. So I do think there's a bit of a difference there.
Steve,
sorry. I'd like to ask the Colonel if, on page 37, do you have the document in front of you?
That's
right. The C part, would that cover the incidents that you have on the ground? C 1, 2 and 3, are those the reasons that consent?
That would cover the situation on the ground. Sure.
Are you 100% sure? Because obviously it's very important that you said there are 50 cases that would be difficult to get consent. And is it only because there's an immediate threat, fear of reprisals?
I think a mixture of the of 1, 2 and 3 there is definitely present with all of those cases.
Prof?
Chair, I would like to support the Colonel. From the studies we made at the University of Zululand on victim surveys,
yes,
we found that victims very seldom give the full story because of fear of victimization. So that's a very important point.
I think it is easy if we can go for option one, if possible, but I would, if we can just get those studies and maybe see if there's justification for not differentiating between them, then just say they don't need consent and, you know, then that might be okay. But let's just see that first. I'm also just interested to hear that he's referring to 50 cases in the Western Cape, because when we asked the police for figures last time around, they said there weren't that many cases in the Western Cape.
All right. Who's going forward? Mrs. Stearman? Yes.
We're still on page 37.
Yes.
Going to subsection 2. Subsection 2 is still the... It's basically the same as what we had in the previous document. Going over to page 38, paragraph B. We've also included there or other disciplinary action, and what was said that we need to delete the word other, so we can also just delete it here. Subsection 4, the second line of subsection 4, what we've done there was just to refer to clause 8.1b or 2b or 9.2. Going to paragraph A under subsection 4. Paragraph A is still the same as what we had in the previous document, except for Roman numeral 2 under paragraph A. In the previous document it was a may, and we have changed it to a must. Yes, we've changed it in Roman numeral 2 to must.
The request of the committee to create a duty on the police.
Going to paragraph B under subsection 4, it states that a police official under paragraph B will must within 24 hours refer the person to an accredited organization and notify the Provincial Department of Social Development. You will see that in the previous document we had a word notify because the police suggested that a word refer should be replaced with a word notify. The suggestion that was made the last time was that the word notify, that we should revert back to the word refer, because it makes much more sense to use the word refer instead of the word notify, and the cost implications, and the question as to who will transport a victim of trafficking to an accredited organization is something that should be dealt with outside of the legislation, and that we do not need to correct it in the legislation by using the word notify. Also, just want to refer you to, you will see that we say there that the person must be referred to an accredited organization, and we use the word and notify the provincial department. In the previous document, we said or referred to the provincial department of social development, and we have changed that in light of the fact that we have amended the definition of accredited organization also to include a government organization. So when you refer an adult victim of trafficking, that will be to an accredited organization, that will either be then an NGO or a government facility, and both of them would be able to be accredited as an accredited organization. And the picture that I have in mind then, when you talk about the provincial department of social development, is people sitting in their offices doing administrative work and not being able to actually accommodate the victim. So in light of that, and also the fact that the Department of Social Development said that they also want government organizations to be accredited, it made more sense to say that you will refer the adult to an accredited organization for purposes of all those services, but that the provincial department of social development will be the one who will do the assessment. That's why we only use the word notify the provincial department of social development.
Okay. Yes.
I prefer that word that you just used now, and relating to the definition of accredited organization, you say includes the government organization. Now, we raised that issue as maybe something that needs to change, but wouldn't facility would be a better word. I see lots of shade nodding heads from social development, including a government facility.
Yes, I think, Chair, the option of facility is perhaps better descriptive, because yes, organization can actually be too vague. Yeah, it should be okay. The thing is, there are instances where, for example, you know, we as the department own a facility, operate a facility, but along the lines of, for example, what was done when you were, you know, accrediting VCT centers, you would accredit across, you know, whether private or public. So we'd also like, even within our own institutions, to go there and see if indeed they meet the requirements of providing the service. So facility is okay. Except, Chair, perhaps, sorry, maybe somebody could then come back and say define facility. Sure.
Yeah, you can expect that.
Going over to page 39, subclause 5 provides that the police official may place an adult person referred to in subsection 4 in temporary safe care pending the transfer of that person to an accredited organization, and we have deleted or a provincial department of social development in light of what we have just said in relation to the previous clause. Also in subclause 6b, we have deleted or provincial department of social development, which has been notified in terms of subsection 4b. Going to subclause 7, you will remember that the committee said that they do not want an accredited organization to assist whether an adult person is a victim of trafficking. And we've now amended it as follows. the Provincial Department of Social Development, which has been notified, is provided for in subsection 4B. We've also made reference there to section 19, entity 3, and we will just come back to this when we deal with those clauses. Must, without delay, in the prescribed manner, assist whether the person concerned is a victim of trafficking. So it will no longer be the accredited organization doing the assessment by the Provincial Department of Social Development. Going to subclause 8, an accredited organization, and we have deleted there all Provincial Department of Social Development. So it will read, an accredited organization which has an adult person who is a victim of trafficking in its care and whose safety is at risk. In the previous document, we had a word may, and we've replaced it with a word must. And at the end of that subclause, we've also deleted the words or Provincial Department of Social Development in line with what we have said previously. Subclause 9 have been deleted, and subclause 9 deals with the assessment by an accredited organization, and in light of the fact that the Provincial Department will now be responsible for that, we have deleted subclause 9. With regard to there's another subclause 9 just below there. We have deleted paragraph A, where we say the Provincial Department of Social Development must consider the outcome of the assessment. Paragraph A is no longer needed because the Provincial Department will be responsible for the assessment itself. The rest of it was provided for in the previous document. Subclause 10 has been in the previous document.
Sorry, just to interrupt you, just in the new subclause 9, as esteemed Minister said, that the Provincial Department of Social Development, if it's satisfied that a person is a victim of trafficking, we've got there an option, either it or the provincial head. And maybe our suggestion would be that the provincial head must be responsible for the issuing of that letter of recognition, so that it's dealt with right at the very, very top at the provincial level.
Going over to page 41, subclause 11 to 13 provides for an appeal mechanism. What we have included in paragraph B under subclause 11, the committee the last time said that a person aggrieved by rescission not to issue a letter of recognition should also be able to appeal against such a decision. So we have just included it in paragraph B. You will see that in we've also included under paragraph B within 14 days. The last time the committee said it, we also need to include time frames. So in terms of paragraph B, the person may within 14 days of being informed of their decision lodge an appeal in the prescribed manner to the MEC having jurisdiction.
You honourable members, you'll notice the question mark after days. Okay.
And also with regard to a subclause 12, the MEC must within 30 days, that's an addition, within 30 days of the appeal being lodged, deal or consider the appeal in the prescribed manner.
Debbie Schaefer?
I think we should say finalise the appeal in the prescribed manner. More approval from Home Social Development.
Yeah.
Going to subclause 14, we have deleted paragraph B, and I'm going to ask Mr. Bassett's assistance here because I can't really remember why we've deleted paragraph B.
Sorry, before that, just if there is unsuccessful, from 13.
If the appeal is unsuccessful, or the affected person does not wish to lodge an appeal, or the affected person does not lodge an appeal. So it's they either appeal and it's unsuccessful, or they fail to lodge an appeal.
But yeah, you intention can't wish to lodge an appeal.
Intention is it's too vague.
Sorry, I must
sub 13.
Basically, the way you've got it, my problem is with the clause, or the affected person does not wish to lodge an appeal. And I'm saying it should be does not lodge an appeal, or if no appeal in terms of whatever the section is lodged.
Yes.
Chair, I don't know if perhaps I'm getting Mr. Jeffries right, but I think we should rather look at it and change the first appeal to application. But, you know, then it, for me, it makes sense that way. Unless we wanted to talk about another further process, which could be some or other review.
No, Chair, I think if everybody's entitled to you make your application, and you can then appeal, one appeal, okay? And the appeal is to the MEC. So that's all there is. There's no more after the MEC. The problem was that this thing about the affected person does not wish to lodge an appeal. It's 13 is what happens next, okay, where the person, there's no appeal, or the person loses their appeal. So appeal is the right word. It doesn't need to be application. My problem was more the wording, the affected person does not wish to lodge an appeal, is too loose. 13 is it should be if the appeal is unsuccessful, or they don't lodge an appeal. In other words, they're then dealt with in the prescribed manner, but they are not a victim of trafficking. I mean, that would only apply, though, in the case where the I don't want to get it over complicated, where the person has been rejected. Obviously, if they've been accepted as a victim of trafficking, another set of processes kick in. This is a case where they got rejected, or the letter was withdrawn under sub 10, and they then appeal and lost the appeal, or the 14 days has passed and they failed to lodge the appeal. I think it's a relatively minor point, but it's become incredibly complicated now. But Mr. Bassett, are you familiar with what my problem was? The problem was referring to the person not wishing to lodge the appeal, that they do not lodge an appeal within the period. Yeah.
So clause 14 deals with an adult person who can be accommodated temporarily at an accredited organization pending a decision. And the one decision is when a person is waiting to be declared to be a victim of trafficking. It's paragraph A, and paragraph C has lodged an appeal if he's unhappy. And then we took that in respect of whom a letter of recognition has been withdrawn. I think it was deleted because a person's letter of recognition can be withdrawn. If you have a look at subclause 10, if the provincial head receives evidence or information that the person in respect of whom a letter of recognition was issued was not a victim at the time the letter was recognised, and I think the thinking was that such a person shouldn't be able to be accommodated temporarily at an accredited organisation.
Mr. Jeffrey.
You've got the problem of the 14 days within which they're deciding whether they want to appeal. So 14.1 is the person who's suspected. Then it would be B now, I suppose. They've lodged an appeal. But you've got the person who's been rejected hasn't yet decided whether they want to lodge an appeal, and they still can because the 14 days hasn't elapsed. So you've got a cover for them too. Once they get rejected by the HOD, they then have a period.
The appeal is just for the provision for that 14-day period.
Could also be the 14 days plus 30 days, really. If they do appeal.
No, because they've appealed and they're covered by the C, the old C, but they've lodged the appeal.
This is right.
This section covers a huge amount, and it's to me, we are already down to sub 15.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to split it up with reporting, with dealing with, and with the issue the appeals, because it's all under one. You start with reporting, then you're dealing with appeals, and then you go back to dealing with. It gets quite cumbersome. On the next page, 42, we've got 15 sub clauses. So maybe once we've got all the wording, we can look at a way of having specific sections dealing with each one of those areas. At the very least, appeals should be in a separate separate section, not subsection.
Just to proceed, subclause 15 is the same as what we had in the previous document, but you will see that we have several options in respect of subclause 15. And the last time the committee actually flagged this, and we still need to get a guidance, the committee's guidance as to which option we should follow here.
Mr. Jeffrey.
I want to suggest that we can't resolve this until we've resolved whether there is an obligation to report. Because if there's no obligation to report, then there's no crime. And we're still waiting for the further information on that aspect.
Sorry, before.
For example, I just wanted to ask earlier, Zambia and Ghana, is it obligatory or is it optional? Is it must?
Both Zambia and Ghana.
And then we were waiting for the further information.
Thank you, Chair. Going to the next clause, dealing with child suspected of being a victim of trafficking, 17.1 and 2.
In the light of the Home Affairs concerns, and these are illegal foreign children, should we not leave these sections for now?
Yeah, we'll flag these as well.
And that will also then relate to subsection 3, where we have two options, one dealing with asylum and the other one with temporary residency. Going to the next clause, dealing with provision of healthcare services. What's new there is sub-clause 2. It was suggested that it should also apply to a foreign victim of trafficking who is suspected of being a victim of trafficking, and we've also added paragraph B to relate to an adult person who has lodged an appeal as provided for in section 1611B.
Okay. And the people in the 14-day period also be included. You've got me on that, similar to the thing. So it's a person who's been rejected. They haven't yet appealed yet under 18.2b, but they still have the 14 days in which to appeal. So you can't sort of stop them. Now, very stupid question. What's the point of 18? I know why it's there, but is that not a constitute? I suppose if we don't have it in, then you might have some funny healthcare worker saying no.
I think that was what Ms. Williams said at the last meeting. Yeah. That was put in very specifically to try and sort out some of that.
Yeah. It would be an adult person who's lodged an appeal or for whom the 14-day period has not yet elapsed.
Going to the next clause.
Just the Department of Health. Department of Health. Will we need to inform them of this provision?
In the new subclause 2 that we've added, because we've already discussed with the Department of Health subclause 1 and they've supported it.
They've supported it?
Yes.
Okay. I hope the minister doesn't call me sometime at night and say, I know nothing of this. All right? So I'll take your word for it.
Okay. Going to the next clause, we have the amendment there to, okay, subclause 1 is still the same as what we had in the previous document. In subclause 2, we have deleted paragraph B and C, and the reason why we've deleted it was because of the committee preference for the option on page 45. And we have a new paragraph B and C there, and in terms of paragraph B, the prosecutor must, in the prescribed manner, in the case of a child, refer the child to a designated child protection organization or the provincial department of social development, which must deal with a child as provided for in the Children's Act. Paragraph C, the prosecutor must, in a prescribed manner, in the case of an adult person, refer that adult person to an accredited organization, and you will also see that we have deleted the word or and said and notify the Provincial Department of Social Development, which must conduct an assessment. So that's basically the option that we have there with regard to clause 2, subclause 2.
Honourable Jeffrey.
Children 1. We basically said when it came to the assessment of whether a child has been trafficked, that is with the Provincial Department, page 35.6. The Provincial Department of Social Development must, without delay in the prescribed manner, assess whether the child concerned is a victim of trafficking. Now you've got a situation which is provided for here. You're in court. The prosecutor suddenly suspects that the child is a victim of trafficking. So you can't now then say that you refer the child to the designated child protection organization to deal with it in this terms of this of the same section that we deleted. So it must be must refer the child, if it's consistent then with sub 635, must refer the child to the provincial department of social development to deal with in the prescribed manner. I mean, so the two sections talk to each other. And we don't have, designated organizations determining whether the child is trafficked or not.
Yeah, that will make sense as far as it relates to child victims of trafficking. I'm just thinking in terms of the Children's Act where you say refer to a designated child protection organization or the Provincial Department of Social Development, but that can deal with all kinds of children, but here we deal specifically with child victims of trafficking, so we will, it makes sense.
It needs to be consistent with 15.6.
Okay.
We'll try the same applies to adults in C. Same story, now they're wanting to send it to an accredited organization for assessment, where we specifically said previously that they must only go to the department.
Now what... not to C, you will refer the person to an accredited organization, and the accredited organization will then deal with all the needs of the person, but then you will notify the Provincial Department of Social Development. But if you go, let me just take you back to the clause where we said that the Provincial Department of Social Development should be responsible for doing the assessment as far as it relates to adults. That is on page 39. You will see that we have referred it to section 19.2c. So if you go back to page 45, we say notify the Provincial Department of Social Development, and we have referred to on page 39 to section 19.2c, which means that once the Provincial Department of Social Development is notified, then in terms of this clause on page 39, they will then have to assess whether the victim is, whether the adult is a victim of trafficking.
Okay, that's fine. I see that now, but now when you go back to the children provision, we're changing that only to the department, and then we're not really providing for their other needs, actually. So maybe we need to differentiate between sending them for the assessment and then the other needs in terms of the Children's Act.
Mr. Jeffrey.
To me, the system makes sense that, and I don't know if it's sort of turning things too much on the head, and it would be that this is a situation in court where the prosecutor realizes that the child or this person may be trafficked. So in the case of the child, we say contact Provincial Social Development to deal with it. And it can be in the manner prescribed, so that can include the regulations can ensure that the provincial department refers it to a child protection organization to care for the child. In the case of an adult, shouldn't it also be just Provincial Social Development to deal with in the manner as prescribed? And then part of that, those regulations can include referring, rather than a situation. I mean, do we have any designated organizations at the moment? Sorry? No, I'm talking about designated organizations in terms of for trafficking.
The department has do
I've got the list here. I've got provincial VEP coordinators. Which seem to be, but I just think I prefer the situation where it is referred to the department to coordinate. So the prosecutor doesn't have to go chasing up designated organizations. It's easier for the prosecutor to go to the department, and then the department must deal with it. Because they're the ones who are meant to be dealing with it. I don't think, prosecutors are necessarily trained with respect to Mr. Nell to sorry, don't look so offended. To deal with social welfare issues. So rather say prosecutor to the Department of Social Development. They then deal with it, and it's then as prescribed.
Can I just come in?
Yes, please.
There was also a request that we have a look and see how we link this up with the Child Justice Act. I spoke to the Department of Social Development about this as well. The first sub-clause there, you're dealing with the child before you get into the trial, and that should come out in the preliminary inquiry in terms of the Child Justice Act. Then the second sub-clause deals with when you're in the middle of a trial and it comes to light. I don't know why it would happen, because in a Child Justice Court that should come to light in a preliminary inquiry, but let's say that does happen. And Social Development is of the view that the probation officers that deal with children in the Child Justice system are perhaps not... They really are restricted to child justice related issues. Here we're looking at something else, and they're suggesting that the child gets referred to, and I'd like them to come in here. I spoke to Mr. Marlowe about that. So they will be dealt with in terms, be referred to the Provincial Department of Social Development.
Yes, I do agree with the reference that has just been made, that the children can be referred to the Department of Social Development, because we know which program or unit will deal with that case adequately in terms of the referral from the prosecutors.
Please.
We still on page 45, going to subclause 3. You will see that we have replaced Children's Court with the Provincial Department of Social Development, because it's not a Children's Court that makes a finding that a child is a victim of trafficking, but in this case, as we have discussed, it will be the Provincial Department of Social Development that will do that. Subclause 4 is still the same as what we had in the previous document.
Mm-hmm.
Going to clause 20, it's still the same as what we had in the previous document, and when we've discussed it, the committee seemed to be in favour of clause 20 as it stands here.
The next chapter is also home affairs related issues. I don't know whether you want to deal with those now.
I think
that.
Skipping what?
Yes. That is, yeah.
Foreign victims. Yeah. Yes. Will that be the whole chapter, Mr. Bassett? All right.
Then we go on to chapter 5.
Yes.
Going to the next chapter, we have amended the heading of the chapter to read accreditation of organizations to provide services to adult victims of trafficking, and we have included it there because this chapter mainly deals with the accreditation of organizations. Going to clause 24, the last time we've asked the committee's guidance as to whether we should use the word referred or dealt with, and the decision was that we should rather go with the word referred. Good. The next amendment that we've made is on page 50, subclause 3, where we have, based on the suggestion by the Department of Social Development, change minimum norms and standards to norms and minimum standards, and we have done that throughout the specific chapter. Going to clause 4, we had to decide between using Minister of Social Development or Director General of Social Development, and the suggestion was made by the Department of Social Development that we should rather use Director General of Social Development. Going to clause 5, the only addition that we have made there was the words prescribed by the Minister of Social Development. And it's the same, going to clause 6 on page 51. Previously we've requested whether we should use the words Minister of Social Development or Director General of Social Development, and the Portfolio Committee agreed that we should rather go with Director General of Social Development. The next amendment was relating to clauses 7 and 8, and you will see that we have deleted clause 7,
mm-hmm.
Just referring you to footnote 243 on page 52, you will see that subclause 7 has been moved to the end of the bill where the regulations are dealt with, as suggested by the committee at our last meeting. But we however feel that these provisions will be better placed in the transitional arrangements. But we also had a meeting with the Department of Social Development, and they expressed the view that the Act should only be amended, only be implemented once all the regulatory or other requirement issues has been finalized, meaning there would be no need for the transitional provision. So the Department of Social Development would like clause 7 to be deleted. We have also deleted subclause 8, and the Department of Social Development agrees that subclause 8 should be deleted because we have now placed the administrative duties. If you go and look at subclause 4, for example, we have placed now the administrative duties on the Director General and no longer on the Minister. And in light of that, they suggested that subclause 8 could be deleted. Going to the next clause, dealing with norms and minimum standards, we've also just changed the heading as explained. And throughout this clause where we refer to the Department of Women, Youth, Children and People with Disabilities, we have corrected it by deleting the word youth as well as the word people. And the correct reference is women, children and persons with disabilities. On page 53, we also have included a new paragraph G to read that the norms and minimum standards must also deal with the manner in which information referred to in subsection 4 is to be collected and collated. Subclause 4 was initially clause 26, and the Portfolio Committee suggested that clause 26 should be moved to the chapter dealing with the administration of the Act, but we feel that it will be better placed here, where you deal with issues relating to accredited organizations, and we have included clause 26 here as subclause 4. It's basically the same, we have just moved it here. The next amendment that we've effected is on page 54. clause, it's still sub clause 4, paragraph C, where we have deleted a reference to the intersectoral committee and have replaced it with the Director General Justice and Constitutional Development. Going to clause 26, we initially had the word 26.1a, Roman numeral 2, it initially read the provision of holistic psychosocial care. But the Department of Social Development felt that not all accredited organizations would be able to provide holistic psychosocial care, and that we should rather use the word counseling. So we've reverted back to the word counseling and deleted holistic psychosocial care. With regard to paragraph B, the Department of Social Development suggested that the word rehabilitation should be replaced with the word therapeutic, but the portfolio committee suggested that we should rather use both these words, and we've included both here. Going over to page 55, clause 27, we've got a new addition there, and it now reads, a person who has been issued with a letter of recognition, and the new addition that we added was, or a person referred to in section 1614. And if you go and look at a footnote in 255, we say a person referred to in clause 1614 is a person who has appealed against a decision of a provincial department of social development not to issue a letter of recognition. So the idea is that those people will still have access to these programs while they wait for the decision in terms of their appeal.
No, it's chair, it should surely be 1614, whichever, B or C, whatever it's going to be now. Because as 1614 also refers to somebody who's been suspected of trafficking. If it's only referring to people who've lodged the appeal, it's only that subsection.
Yeah, we will have to go and look at it and just refer to the specific subsection. Clause 28 is still the same, but we have discussed clause 28 again with the Department of Social Development. You will see the last line, we need to make a decision whether we're going to use long-term or future needs, and the department felt that one should rather use the word long-term needs instead of future needs. You will also see that we have deleted clause 29, which deals with the return of adult victims of trafficking within the Republic. If you look at footnote 257, you will see that a committee suggested that this clause should be moved to the chapter dealing with repatriation, and that that chapter should also deal with the return of victims which have been trafficked within the borders of South Africa, and we will deal with this clause when we get to the chapter.
Yes. You sound like an economist.
I don't know. I presume it's not going to be in every case that there's a long-term need.
Well, I think we've been asked to make a choice there between long-term or future.
Yeah, I don't have an objection to it because one does need to plan the future, but the first thing might be return. After this, if it's a return victim, then it's a long-term beyond returning the victim, even beyond that.
I don't think that's the idea, because what the accredited organization will have to do will be to draw up a plan for the victim until the stage where the victim exit, you know, where the victim is reintegrated into the community, and I think there the role will end, because I don't think accredited organizations will have the resources to go beyond reintegration of the victim in the community.
The medium term needs of the No, I appreciate it. That's fine.
It's actually an important issue, because we need to then maybe put a bit more clarity onto that in the bill, because, you know, I mean, long term, there could be very, very long term consequences for people who psychologically and so on. So we need to maybe tighten that up a bit, I think.
It is an accepted economic term. One's got to be bear in mind. Short term is, you get immediate, you get short term, you get medium term, and you get long term. So,
the Honourable Jeffrey.
Why did social development want long term, not future? Future actually makes more sense to me.
Hello, I think in terms of our intervention phases, we have immediate, short-term, and long-term. And long-term does include also a clear exit plan that has been developed for the particular victim that will be accommodated in a facility. So long-term doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be perpetually keeping the person in the facility, but the person will have a clear exit plan in terms of when and how will he exit that particular facility.
I heard short term. Did I hear correctly? Immediate, short term, and long term. That would cover the all. That would cover it.
What about having immediate and reasonable future needs? Because there's nothing, as far as I can recall from the bill, that says that there's going to be an exit plan or whatever. And I really think we need to tighten that up so people don't have the expectation that their state is going to continue forever and ever. Yeah.
Social development, think about that.
Yes, we don't have the word exit plan in the bill, but when we look at our management of victims within the facilities, this is one of the requirements that we need to have to ensure that the victim has been properly assessed with a clear care plan or an individual plan, which will lead us to an exit plan ultimately. So those are the processes that are aligned to the long-term services that will be rendered to the victim. And those are something that we are also looking at in terms of our regulations to ensure that whoever that is going to accommodate a victim of human trafficking needs to know all those processes and be able to come up with a clear plan on the exit of the particular victim.
But Chair, look, I think we're talking about two different things. The bill, the text before us talks about needs. It's a question of whether they're long-term needs or future needs. Social development's concern is they do not want an obligation to have to provide for this victim indefinitely. So that's why they're talking about exit plans. So, you know, I agree with that. But the problem is that's not what, whether long-term or future doesn't provide for exit plans. Because it's in the bill. It's long-term needs or future needs. So I don't think either long-term or future, long-term needs or future needs addresses social development's concern. And that's where the sort of reasonable future needs starts qualifying. Because it's a need, actually, that is referred to here. Otherwise, you must come up with a different wording altogether. But I don't think there's much difference between long-term need and future need.
Can I just check, and perhaps social development can also assist? Because if you look at Clause 26, Clause 26 provides that an accredited organization must offer a program aimed at the reintegration of an adult victim of trafficking into their family or communities. Is there not, you know, will your exit plan not form part of the reintegration of your victim into communities? Because that is where your victim will then leave the system.
I think I'm not sure you
want to answer that, but maybe we need to make specific reference to exit plans in some way in this section.
Yes, sir. Just a suggestion, Chair. I think perhaps our challenge with this clause could be perhaps from the profession's perspective, there is a certain terminology that is used which perhaps is understood generally within the profession. I mean, for example, if they refer to a plan, short term, long term, you know, long, whatever, they understand it within the profession. But of course here we're dealing with a general, you know, public document that needs to be understood by everyone. So perhaps, yes, it could be necessary to clarify certain aspects. I'm not so sure if maybe we should rather than prescribe, you know, some of the, you know, elements of the plan itself. So instead of talking here in this document, in the draft, I mean in the bill itself, instead of talking of the future, the whatever needs, if there's a professionally acceptable way of what is, you know, intended to be contained in a care plan, I think you called it a care plan? In a care plan, we could say, you know, in a care plan, as prescribed, and you know, whoever then gets into the detail of it needs to refer to the regulations. Just a suggestion.
What about saying something like draw up a plan to address the needs of that victim until such time as they exit whatever the thing is called?
So quite clearly there has to be an exit plan, and the victim concerned must be made aware of that fact right at the outset, so that there's no expectation of staying in the facility for the rest of their lives. Okay. First Mr. Jeffrey and then the Colonel.
I want to go back to 27.
Colonel, are you dealing with this particular point?
I'm still, Mr. Chair, I'm still there by section 28. I think we must take cognizance of the fact that every victim is essentially going to be a possible witness here.
Sure.
So your exit plan, whatever plan you devise for that victim, and the wording of that section is going to have that in mind, because some victims will be ready to exit when they are reintegrated with the families or in their countries, whatever. Other victims might only be ready to exit when the court case has concluded.
And you reckon witness protection won't assist there?
At this stage, we have looked at witness protection with a human trafficking scenario. They do not qualify.
Why not?
They had various technical reasons why they could not accommodate our victims of human trafficking.
No. You said they don't qualify. And now you're talking about technical reasons. No. That's two different things.
They disqualified them on a number of technical reasons. First, we had to prove that these people's lives were definitely in danger. We had to have proof that there was in fact a possibility that they might get killed, or there's a real threat that they might get killed. In 90% of those cases that we've dealt with, we cannot prove that. We can prove that the person was trafficked. We can prove that the person was a victim of trafficking. But we certainly can't prove that the person will get killed should he be left anywhere else besides in witness protection.
Okay. Honorable David Schaefer.
Looks like we need to address that now in this bill then, maybe. We can make specific provision for witnesses, I mean, for people who are prepared, who can exit a care program, but then they must be accommodated in witness protection programs if they have been, have been given a letter of recognition as a trafficking victim.
The Honourable John Jeffrey.
No, look, the Witness Protection Act is for witnesses who need protection.
Yes.
Okay. from what the Colonel is saying, these are not necessarily witnesses who need protection. Well, these are not witnesses who need protection.
Okay.
They just need a place to stay. That seems to be the issue. Yes. Okay. So there's nothing wrong, I think, with witness protection. The issue is basically because they were moved, trafficked, they've got nowhere to stay. And there needs to then be some way but they can't be lumped on witness protection because they don't need protection. Okay. Well, they don't need protection. If they needed protection, they would then qualify protection. Am I right? Yes. Okay, that's all that the thing is. And I think it's simply some kind of way. I mean, maybe there's the catch-all of as prescribed. That regulations can prescribe. But I think the issue is basically that in the long-term aspect, one of the factors that needs to be looked at, and that's where it's a bit cumbersome to put it in the bill, is whether this person is, their presence is required in a particular place, location, as a witness, and therefore the state needs to provide them with accommodation until such time as the trial is completed. You don't want them going back to a rural area or going somewhere else to look for work or something. That just needs to be built in, but it seems to be more something that could be dealt with by way of regulation.
All right.
Can I go back to 27?
Yes.
Okay.
Look, it's a very minor but a technical point, and that is the reference to the person referred to in 1614.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they do need to continue getting access to accommodation, but the other programs, which are, I think there's a bit of a contradiction. I mean, that why should they? They've been rejected as a victim of trafficking. They're appealing. They're saying, no, the social development is wrong. But while... And they need to be accommodated, definitely. So what's offered under 26.1A1 is there. But I don't think it's correct that they continue on the program of counseling to trafficked victims when it's not clear whether they are, well, where there's a dispute, there's a ruling, in fact, from social development that they're not trafficked. That they are having rehabilitation and therapeutic services to trafficked victims when, at least on a lower level, they're found not to to be a trafficked victim. So I just feel that the other services under 26, that the appellant should not be entitled to those. Now, I don't know how one deals with it. As I said, it's quite technical, and already this thing is complicated enough. But I don't know if there's some way of making it. Maybe one leaves out under 27 the aspect of the person referred to in section 1614. Leave it out, and then under the section on the appeals, put that they're still entitled to accommodation and lodging, that kind of thing. So deal with it that way, maybe the way around it. Because definitely you can't kick them out and stop feeding them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they shouldn't be entitled to more when, in fact, there's a dispute as to whether they're a victim of trafficking, and they're just trying to ride the system for as long as possible to get things.
Just on that, when Priority 1614 already deals with the temporary accommodation, so...
Maybe accommodated temporarily.
I think we'll have to just take it out of 27 then.
But the problem of the maybe is it's. No, I suppose it's better as maybe. I was going to say, should it be must be if they want?
Well, honourable members while Mr. Best is police are asking if they could please be excused because they have pre-booked flight tickets. And the only issue left for them to deal with perhaps is the national instruction, which is quite way down the bill. We're already at 4 o'clock, 5 past. They will have another session. Yes, there will be another session. Yes. Are we okay with that? All right. Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Bassett. Yes.
Wondering out loud, I'm learning bad habits from Mr. Jeffrey, but what is there no possibility maybe of accommodating the police's issue under 1614 as well then? For example, they're entitled to accommodation for as long as they may be needed to be there for the purposes of a... Okay, well, not really. Not. It's suspected of being a victim of trafficking or has lodged an appeal. So we could say suspected of being a victim, always lodged an appeal, always required to be to remain in wherever we're in a certain place for the purposes of being a witness in criminal proceedings. Something like that?
In practice, what we've been doing in the absence of the legislation now, what we've been doing in practice, when we come across a person that we're not sure whether this person is in fact a victim of trafficking or not, the NGOs that we work with, they are very often prepared to accommodate that person until such a time that we can say for sure whether that person is a victim or not. In fact, it often happens that the person is too traumatized to interview that person effectively in the first 24 hours. So what we do, we contact the NGOs, they accommodate that person for about 24 hours or so, we then do an interview, and if the person is then confirmed to be a victim, then we contact DSD. So there is a system that we're using out there, but I don't know how we're going to get that system built into the legislation. That's a bit of a tricky one.
Well, maybe by regulation. General, it's fine. It's fine.
Delivering to the transport. That's your vehicle to service.
You see, the difficulty with it under there is that I think the witnesses in the cases are the ones that are going to be needing accommodation for some time. So the 16 one is it should be a short space of time before the person gets certified. I mean, what is it called? Gets written as a whatever. What's the word? But anyway, gets determined to be a victim of trafficking. So the people that the Colonel is speaking about are people who have been recognised and whose accommodation is required for some length of time. So whereas Section 16(1)s are the temporary ones. So I think it needs to be accommodated elsewhere. I don't think that's the right place. But I think with the and it's specific. It's not relating to the other programs. It's specifically for accommodation.
That is correct.
Yeah. We need to find some way of putting it in. But I do think that then this under 27, the person referred to in section 1614, comes out.
I really think it's an important issue. I mean, we don't want to have victims of trafficking who are witnesses in cases, and then we've got nowhere to put them, and there's no obligation on anyone to keep them here, and then the police can't prosecute their case, and then they get lambasted for their low conviction rate.
No dispute, it's a question for me.
All right. You will look at that?
Yes.
All right.
The last clause in this chapter on page 56, information management, you will see we have deleted it here, but actually just moved it to clause 25.4 on page 53. But haven't made any other changes to the specific clause in itself.
Okay. Move to?
We go to chapter 6, Chair, which deals with compensation.
No, where is this clause moved to?
Clause.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Bassett. All right, page 57, compensation, chapter 6.
I'll deal with this portion. Clause 29 deals with compensation to victim of trafficking, and you'll see footnote 263 there is relevant. We were asked by the committee on the last occasion to keep subclauses 1 and 2 and to make the provisions of section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act applicable. I would just like to take you through it. There is a suggestion there that a court may, subject to paragraph C, on its own accord at the request of the complainant, and a suggestion is there is perhaps limited to or make a victim of trafficking, in addition to any sentence which it may impose in respect of any offence under Chapter 2, order a person convicted of the offence to pay compensation to any victim four, and we set out those, and we recognise that the four issues that are there are broader than what's contained in Section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which limits it to damage or loss, I think, loss of property. And we have then said, whereafter the provisions of Section 300, subsection 2, subsection 3, and subsection 4 of the Criminal Procedure Act apply. Perhaps it's important to go through what of Section 300 is being made applicable. It's Section 302, subsection 2, which reads as follows. For the purpose of determining the amount of compensation or the liability of the convicted person, therefore, the court may refer to the evidence in the proceedings at the trial or hear further evidence either upon affidavit or orally. In subsection 3, which is also made applicable, an award, and I think this is important, an award made under this section by magistrate's court shall have the effect of a civil judgment of that court, and an award made under this section by a regional court shall have the effect of a civil judgment of the magistrate's court of the district in which the relevant trial took place. That's paragraph A of subsection 3. Paragraph B, subsection 3 reads, where a superior court makes an award under this section, the registrar of the court shall forward a certified copy of the award to the clerk of the magistrate's court designated by the presiding judge, or if no such court is designated, to the clerk of the magistrate's court in whose area of jurisdiction the offence in question was committed, and thereupon such award shall have the effect of a civil judgment of that magistrate's court. And then we also make subclause 4 applicable. Where money of the person convicted is taken from him upon his arrest, the court may order that payment be made forthwith from such money in satisfaction or on account of the award. Now, what we're not making applicable, and I would like to just bring it to your attention, is the last subsection of section 300, and that's subsection 5A and B. And in effect, subsection 5 precludes a person who's been given and who's all precludes a person who in his favour an award has been made in terms of this Criminal Procedure Act provision from instituting a civil action against that person. So I thought I'd just bring that to your attention.
So High Court's not dealt with at all in terms of these civil...
It is in Section 301 provides where a person is convicted by a superior court, a regional court, or a magistrate's court. We're not using subsection 1, we're just saying a court. So it would include include any court. But
in respect of the civil, in respect of the judgment, then you're specifying it will have the same effect as a court, for a regional court, as a jurisdiction with the magistrate court.
Yeah.
But what about the High Court?
No, I read the one about the High Court. Where a superior court makes an award under this section, the registrar of the court shall forward a copy of that award to the magistrate's courts, and thereupon has the effect of a civil judgment of that magistrate's court. Where we are also differing from section 300, we are now pertinently saying in subclause 2 on the bill, in cases where the amount of the damage, injury or loss suffered exceeds let me just continue in the bill. So I've told you what provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act will apply. Subclause 1B provides appropriate compensation, includes expenses reasonably expected to be incurred in relation to the matters referred to in paragraphs 1, subparagraphs 1 to 4 of subsection 1A, and then subclause C says a magistrate's court may not make an order for the amount for the payment of compensation as provided for in paragraph A, which exceeds the monetary jurisdiction determined by the Minister from time to time by notice in the Gazette as provided for in Section 301A of the Criminal Procedure Act. And Section 301A of the Criminal Procedure Act says that a magistrate's court may not make an order if it exceeds the amount determined by the Minister from time to time in the Gazette. What we're also doing in subclause 2, we say, and that's at the request of the committee the last time, that where a magistrate's court is limited to a certain level that can make orders, if the claim for compensation exceeds that amount, then the person has a civil remedy, which sort of neutralizes what subsection 5 of section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act says. I said it in a very roundabout way. I hope you've understood what I've been trying to.
Mr. Swart, followed by Advocate Nell.
I think that's fine, Chair. The concern about the constitutionality, I think, would probably apply to other legislation that does not have this section, because surely this section here benefits victims of crime constitutionally, and therefore I don't think that it's right to say the question is raised in your footnote about the constitutionality, whether this act, because it benefits other people, is unconstitutional. Surely other acts then which don't have this could be open, and that's why it's important for us to insert in our resolution.
That's correct.
To look at those other acts.
What we did do on that and on that aspect, Chair, is Ms. Stan had a look, and it was in the discussion document of the Law Commission during the investigation phase, and perhaps she can just relay information that she found there as sort of motivation for a departure from crimes in general.
The Law Commission's discussion paper on page 206 provides certain reasons why it may not be unconstitutional. The first one is, like, unlike other victims of crime, victims of trafficking are usually subjected to abuse over a long period of time. The abuse often takes place in an unfamiliar environment, which increases their vulnerability. Psychological harm inflicted on these victims because of the period of crime and the unfamiliar environment may be greater. The extent of intimidation may be greater because of involvement of organized criminal groups. The traffickers usually have the financial means to compensate the victims. And then, of course, the trafficking protocol places a duty on state parties to provide measures that offer victims the possibility to obtain compensation.
What is the amount
What is the amount at the moment? The maximum amount in the
gazette? I think it's, and I do speak under corrections, 100,000, and maybe somebody from the prosecuting authority can help me. I think it's 100,000 and 300,000 in the case of a regional court.
Jurisdictional limits for Section 300.
That's right, yeah. I can get those figures, I just don't have them off the top of my head.
Advocate, now. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We support this, but we propose that in subsection or subclause 1, we stop there at commission of the offence and then insert a new paragraph saying that the provisions of section 300 sub 2, 3 and 4 are applicable with the necessary changes required by the context with regard to a compensation order referred to in subsection 1. It's saying exactly the same, but it's more in line with legislation referring to with the necessary changes if necessary.
I don't understand what changes which context. What changes are you envisaging?
Well, no, you have to look at the section itself and see, then you'll have to read in, if they refer, in, for instance, to a concept, then you'll have to see whether that concept has to change in line with what we've got here.
Bit vague for my liking, Mr. Chair. I think we should maybe get those sections and just see if there's anything we need to specifically address. Yeah. Could we just have this subsections 2, 3 and 4 so we can just have a proper look? Ah, well done. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the NPA suggestion, can we not get it in writing?
Yes. Advocate Nell.
Can I
read it for you again?
No. We want it in writing.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Let's see the NPA submission in proposal in writing.
First, do you want it now? He's not in a position.
Well, he's not in a position now. He's not prepared.
Yes.
But I mean, we'll have to forward it to
forward
the department.
To the department and
yeah.
Vanelli.
Yeah.
All right. Mr. Chair, again, we received this. I received this. I looked at it this morning. I discussed it with Mr. Bassett.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is the ordinary provision. And the state law advisor can maybe assist here. It's exactly the same as what Mr. Bassett's saying. It's just that we're saying that you must read it in context.
The sections deal with execution, basically. I can't see what has to change. I mean, it'll apply anyway. There's nothing that I can see in any of these three or four or five sections. We're already saying that 5 doesn't apply, so that's not relevant. We're saying that 3, 4, and 5 apply, which says, let's just have a look, 2, 3, 4, and 5. 2 is how you can call for further evidence. That's not, I don't see what needs to change there. 3 is award made or have the effect of a civil judgment.
That's purely a draft in improvement. All we're going to look at, it's not change in the context, it's an improvement on the draft. Let's look at it and we can consider.
I don't think it's a debate. Let's look at the. I don't think we're debating something we're not clear, semantics that we don't even have in front of us. Let's. It's understandable then if the NPA only saw the document this morning. Let's see their proposed wording and we can take it from there.
Okay.
So, that's all what Clause 29 is about, Chair. The rest, the committee indicated at our last meeting that they must come out. Those deal with the execution of of compensation orders.
All the way up to the top of page 59.
That's correct.
Okay.
Just a bit of background. Can we move on to the next provision? And that's
declaration of forfeiture.
Yeah, that's a provision that we still must confess we're still grappling with in the department. It was a proposal made by the NPA in June. We went and had discussions with Mr. Hardicke last week, and I prepared this provision on the basis of our discussions. He's come up with counter proposals that aren't in this document, and I'm not too sure how we should deal with it now. I'm still not in my mind absolutely clear what the NPA or the asset forfeiture unit want as far as this provision is concerned. So I've got copies here that I can make available if Mr. Hardicke wants to go through that. I would.
It would really be the principled issue, and it's similar to that provision in the beginning around the investigation, the investigative order. What was it called? Yeah, the investigation that we rejected. Why do we need this? As far as I can see, it is taking aspects from POCA and putting them in here. But now, if there's been organized crime involved in trafficking, then POCA must be dealt with. It's a question of is this the correct place? Because, okay, it may be Mr. Bassett's wording, but the requirement is to declare assets, cash, immovable property, which constitutes an instrumentality of an offence, or the proceeds of unlawful activities to be forfeited to the state. Now, both of those concepts are POCA concepts. And if you look at the definition, if you look at the definition of an instrumentality of an offence, or the proceeds of unlawful activities, you'll see a reference to POCA. My question and concern is, does this belong here? If organized crime, where there has been an instrumentality of an offence or proceeds of unlawful activities because it's been organized crime have been involved in trafficking, then surely POCA should be used for forfeiture rather than this legislation.
Yes, Mr. Hardicke.
Thank you, Chair. We agree with Mr. Swart that Mr. Jeffries, that the asset forfeiture provisions in POCA would basically address what has been submitted in the document before the committee relating to what Mr. Bassett has proposed. Our counter proposal certainly differs from that, and it goes beyond what is contained in the provisions of POCA. What I can do is read out the draft that we've got and see whether it's found to be too contentious.
The Chair, same story. We can't see it if we haven't got it in writing.
We're coming now. Quite lengthy, too. It's two pages. Yeah, I know. If at the worst we'll let it, we'll flag it. It's a bone of contention with members of Parliament. They're given stuff and expected to take a decision the minute they're given. And it makes it very difficult to apply your mind to what is contained in this in relation to the bill we're dealing with. But, all right, let's hear you.
The proposal is that whenever any person is convicted of an offence under Chapter 2, the court convict him or her may, in addition to any penalty which it may impose in respect of that offence, declare A. any movable property, subclause 1, which was carried on the person of the convicted person at the time of his or her arrest, or subclause 2 found in the close proximity of the convicted person at the time of his or her arrest. And I don't know whether these additions are on in the copy you have before you, subclause 3, or carried on his or her person or found in the close proximity of the convicted person whilst he or she was upon or in the vicinity of a venue as described in subparagraph B3 infra. And a fault here is to include when that person is in the presence of or the vicinity of a victim. And then B is any immovable property which was used to facilitate the commission of the offence, which was one, to facilitate the commission of the offences, subclause 2, which made the offences easier to commit or more difficult to detect, and subclause 3, which was used as a venue to harbour or receive victims of the offence under chapter 2.
Where does this come from?
That hasn't been drawn from any existing legislation. It's because of the unique relationship between traffickers and the victims of human trafficking.
Yes, but tear through you. I mean, if you look at A3, any immovable property that was found in the close proximity of the convicted person whilst he or she was in the vicinity. So, you know, your car could be there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, your car, my car. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're not the accused. And it's near where the accused was found, the convicted person. And you know, suddenly then that can be seized.
That isn't the intention.
It's not the intention, that's but what the wording can imply. It is that, I mean, 2 is you know, you lend somebody your cell phone. Mm. They happen to be, or not, maybe cell phones are not a good example. But you lend somebody something. Okay, yeah, your car or your laptop. And they get arrested, and they were involved actually in trafficking, and they get arrested and they get convicted. And suddenly, this thing which is not theirs is forfeited.
That's why there are the innocent owner provisions that are included further down to deal with that and give protection to innocent parties involved.
Removing the requirement that it must be an instrumentality of the offence for those A Roman 1, 2 and 3. So you don't have to, it does not have to be an instrumentality of an offence.
That's correct.
That's surely too wide.
Sure. Wow.
To prove that the trafficker with his upmarket car, Rolex watch, gold chain, who portrays this image of wealth and power, which assists him in controlling the victims, is going to, there may be difficulties in proving that the nexus between those items are sufficiently to prove them to be instrumentalities, but certainly in the context of these type of offences, if they are specified as items that are subject to seizure, it puts the trafficker in a situation where he either chooses to take the chance that he'll lose them, or ensure that he doesn't portray the aura of wealth, which will then make it more difficult for him to exercise control over the victims.
And woe betide anybody who is anywhere near him or her.
The whole issue of the instrumentality requirement, I mean, that Mr. Bassett has, or the instrumentality or proceeds of unlawful activities in poker, is so that there's a linkage between this material property and the crime for which the person has been convicted.
I think really the NPA have well, Debbie's saying lost the plot. I think I agree with her. It is too wide. You know, it's never going to, this then becomes a penalty. And what you are specifically saying is that you want to punish the flashy convict, but then you punish them through sentencing. So I think this is a complete non-starter. And it then makes me doubly worried about the provisions of the sentencing, because I mean, in fact, they are they've upped the cash penalties in the sentences 15-fold. Now they want to they've upped them 15-fold. Okay, they may be maximum sentences, but they've still upped them 15-fold from what they were in the introduced bill. And now they want to have another sentencing provision. This is a sentence. Okay? You have a flashy watch, as the NPA have said. You have a flashy watch, you have a flashy car, you lose it. It's a sentence. It's a punishment. Mm-hmm. And I just think that they've taken leave of their senses in terms of getting this through. And I do think that it really would be better dealt with in terms of an overall approach to sentencing, rather than piecemeal in terms of let's deal with it now for trafficking. But is this going to pass constitutional muster?
If this is going to be too much of a bone of contention, then I don't think there's any necessity to take it any much further forward.
I mean, my other difficulty is this is quite a major provision. We can't just slip it in. I mean, there is a dispute around public involvement, but this is not something that was in the introduced bill. So it's a new provision that we're adding. I just think, I mean, my view is I've got sympathy for forfeiture to the state, but then let it rather be through the poker legislation, which is tried and tested. And then, but the provisions that you're coming with now are additional sentencing provisions. They are. You know, you want to punish the person, not for having used for simply having this flashy car, this flashy watch, this flashy whatever else, and ensuring that if they get bust for trafficking, they lose it. But it doesn't matter that under. They were already subject to life imprisonment. I mean,
It's also to discourage them from being able to show how powerful they are through the wealth that they habitually carry with them. But if this is too much of a contentious issue. I don't think that it's going to be serving any purpose to delay these proceedings any longer on this.
I know there was a desire not to carry on too late this afternoon. We've got bogged down on the refugee foreign victims provision, which we've got to resolve. So I don't think we necessarily have to. I would rather say those would be initial responses, which I must say were shock and horror. I'm not saying we dispense with that. We've just seen it now. Let's look at it. Let's consider it. But I think the thing would be. My initial concerns, as I said, would be: are they? So I'm saying let's not shoot it out of the water entirely. But the problem would be new provisions slipped in, very far-reaching provisions in terms of consequences, going far wider than poker, which already was quite advanced in terms of what the state could get. Now this is basically assets, property that's not linked to the crime as it had to be with poker. And my gut feel is use, if it's organized crime and you want to get assets forfeited, use poker. And if the NPA want to start zapping other things, because I see it as a punishment, then rather look at it comprehensively rather than just in trafficking, and allow it to be subject to effective public scrutiny.
I think that the reason that we're trying to introduce this only in the trafficking bill is because of the unique situation between the trafficker and the victim, where the power and wealth play a role, where one isn't going to necessarily be able to use that as a general clause introduced or amendment introduced into poker.
There are other crimes, I mean, drug lords, gangs, flashing.
I'll just ask Mr. Chair, is asset forfeiture only provided for in poker?
The asset forfeiture that the asset forfeiture unit in the NPA relies on is contained in poker, yes. It's Chapter 5 and Chapter 6.
And I mean, how many cases of trafficking don't involve organized crime? Because, I mean, as far as I understand, generally it is an organized crime thing.
It has to be.
It's got to be. I mean, I think there's very few, if any, trafficking offences that are not going to be covered by poker. So, I mean, I do sympathise with your views on it. I mean, and yes, we certainly do want to stop people from benefiting from crime. But surely it's going to be, well, the Lipsy man, can you respond on that?
In the Western Cape right now, we've got at least two that's on the court rolls where we have applied for permission to carry on with poker.
But how many of the cases that you deal with regarding trafficking are not organized crime?
Not organized. Virtually all of them are organized.
I don't think, I mean, I agree, this is way over the top. And I mean, you say it's all very well having somebody saying, you know, if they're innocent, then it's okay. But if they're innocent, they have to go and apply to court to get their own property back. It's crazy.
The same applies if Section 300 is applied even. If what is going to be seized, or not 300, Section 35 of the Criminal Procedure Act even. What is going to be forfeited there?
See, I think we need to think carefully about it. I don't think we should just dismiss it. I think this is we need to bear in mind the uniqueness of the trafficked victim, the relationship. Many of them have come of trafficked from foreign crimes. It is a bit broad. The one concern would be that poker has already been tested in the Constitutional Court largely.
That's great.
And I think that in itself would satisfy me that if you are, I wouldn't mind repeating the wording, but I do understand what you're trying to do is stretch the boundaries, but you're obviously opening in yourself then constitutional challenge and convictions that could then be delayed because of constitutional appeals on that, and again then dragging out, because I know when we passed the poker legislation it took a long time for it to be tested and to work properly.
The jurisprudence took some time. Yes.
Exactly. And I think it's the point I made the other day. Are you not opening yourself to the same challenges here with stretching the boundaries, and that you might want to reconsider that? I see that in the example that we gave, this document, NPA report on finalized trafficking cases, I see there's trafficking cases where poker was successfully used.
Yes, it has been.
So it does seem that we need to give it careful thought. I'm not keen to just dismiss it, but I want to say you need to bear in mind that you might well have those constitutional challenges.
We're aware of that, and the proposals that were put forward by Mr. Bassett of pretty much a verbatim extract from poker, my principals have considered and then suggested that we try and broaden it rather than just duplicate poker.
I want us to wrap this up now, Mr. Jeffrey.
Look, it's maybe blowing hot and cold. I mean, in terms of not saying kill it, but what horrifies me, and it really is horrifying, poker is instrumentalities and proceeds of crime. So there's a direct linkage between the crime and the assets. Here you've just somehow zapped everything. And I really think that I do think you've taken leave of your senses on that.
The principles, not.
Thank you.
Honourable members, Mr. Bassett.
Just to mention, it was mentioned previously, there are forfeiture similar clauses like, or provisions like this. I think it started off, the NPA proposal, largely around provisions in the Drug and Drug Trafficking Act. And the provision that I tried to draft here is also, I borrowed some from the Drug and Drug Trafficking Act. And also just to mention that I asked Engela Steyn to have a look and see whether other trafficking legislation has forfeiture provisions, and there are some other countries that do have the forfeiture provisions. So I'm just mentioning that for what it's worth.
All right.
Can
we
have copies at the next time?
No, I mean, Chair, but I just need clarity. I mean, forfeiture in respect of proceeds of that specific offence, or general forfeiture of any property in the area?
I want us to stop now. We'll pick up again when next we deal with trafficking. Mr. Bassett. Tomorrow we're supposed to be dealing with the legal aid.
Yeah, we've got the whole... I was the one who said any day on trafficking. I don't think there's much to go.
Right.
We've just got the legal amendments to the legal aid guide. So
right.
Again, maybe I'm over-optimistic. But I would hope when we are sitting at 9, maybe we could
start again at about 10, 11.
Well, no, maybe look, either we start with this and tell legal aid to come later, which is probably unfair on legal aid, or we, I don't know if legal aid has been told to come at a particular time.
They're arriving at 10.
Why don't we start at 9? And
with,
if they,
what's trafficking?
With trafficking, and if they have to go on to
11,
I mean, it's maybe 2 hours.
Right. Okay, sounds good. With regard to the Deputy Public Protector, I've decided she's insisting on coming.
Mm-hmm.
There's two options. Very nice to let her come, and then we don't deal with her matter. That's the one option. The other option, all right, well, okay. The other option is I'll ask Advocate Nonko Sikwechwayo to contact them and just have a quiet diplomatic word with him and say, look, you leave yourself open to embarrassment if you insist on going.
If you can get
hold of
that, fine.
I will.
Because, Chair, look, it's open to the public. If she wants to come, she can come.
No, she can, but...
But the difficulty, as you say, is that she's then going to get asked. I mean, she was appointed in 2005 under specific terms and conditions.
Yeah.
They now want to backdate this from the date of appointment.
Yes.
The one aspect for me is okay, they want to peg it at the court salary of a judge. The public protector is at the level of the JP.
JP. Yes.
They want the deputy to be at the level of a judge.
Judge.
So the question is going to be, is what the, does she want to answer these questions? The question for me is, does what the Deputy Public Protector do, is it that responsible?
But it's not appropriate that she must answer, it should be the Public Protector who answers.
Yes.
That's the issue.
He's going to say no, it's not.
Yeah, quite obviously. She says no, and then what do you do?
It's a JP. She wants no JP.
Well, okay.
That's
a separate issue. At some point we must raise it.
I must go back and check on it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bassett and your team, and everyone else.
No, I know that.
Are you with tomorrow?
Unani will SMS us the venue for tomorrow.
What time?
Nine. What time are you going to SMS?
I want your card.